A reminder or a note to those who are here for the first time, two books that are the basis of this one, Marcus Borg, Jesus, A New Vision, and then two, Gerard Tyson, The Shadow of the Galilean, which is very interesting. I wish I would have had the bookstore order it. It's, as I mentioned yesterday, it's this story about a Jewish double agent working for the Roman Empire during the time of Jesus and finding out all kinds of things. So if you don't like to read biblical work like scholarly and would like to read basically the same thing in a story form, this is the book.
I've got a confession. I had it checked out, and after your session yesterday, I felt guilty. So I brought it down and put it in the resource center.
Oh, The Shadow?
Yes.
Shadow of the Galilean?
Okay. Oh, and I've also got the other, the library copy.
So you have a hearing aid. Is that a novel?
Yeah. Oh, do you know, does anyone know where the hearing?
Oh. I'll go see if there's any.
They're usually right here.
Is that book a novel?
It's like a novel. You know, I'd say novelette.
Some fact in it?
Yeah, well, it brings out all the facts, but it does it in story form, narrative form.
Oh.
Yeah. Which I think is, it's a fun way to do biblical studies. So I'll try to talk up loudly, so. But did
well,
someone
I think,
find
I think
it?
She's getting one.
Okay.
Thank you, Dan.
Good. Yesterday we looked at Jesus, and really, in a way, it was a study of Jesus, maybe from the standpoint of religions and societies in general, ancient people, indigenous people, who have people that are come up in their midst as holy people, spirit people, two-dimensional societies. Where certain people have that sense of presence in the spirit world. They communicate the power of that presence and really looked, and I think for me it was a first time to look at Jesus as a spirit person in a very traditional culture. Now, today, I'm hardly going to talk about Jesus. Is that okay? I apologize because this is called Jesus 2. And we'll hardly talk about Jesus because our purpose of our meeting today is to describe the social setting that Jesus came into. And so you know where I'm going. Session 1, Jesus, spirit person who lives in the realm of God. Number 2 today, to look at the social political world of Jesus. And then tomorrow, what did it mean for Jesus to have this vision of God to enter into this society? Do you follow that? That's where we'll be moving. So the social world of Jesus. And a lot of today will be information. And so I'll share it, and I'll try my best that it not be a boring lecture. Okay, that's my commitment. And I don't know if I should take a check halfway through, like, raise your hand if this is boring. but I want to have time, too, to talk, clarify, and hope I'll finish, so we'll have some time to talk about what the world was like at the time of Jesus. And if I have a goal today, or in teachers, I suppose, have lesson plan objectives, it would be in a small way to feel what it would have been like, or what it was like to live in Palestine at the time of Jesus. Okay, I'll begin from Marcus Borg, is just what he means by the social world of Jesus. Social world or social environment, of course, includes all the things that kind of make up a society, including the type of economic relationships, power arrangements, technology or lack, rural or urban, population mixture, all kinds of things like that. But in a deeper sense, he means It's the shared beliefs and values that a community of people had. The reason I stopped here, I don't know if that word should have been had or had. It was singular or plural, I forgot. But the shared beliefs and values that those people really was behind the way they lived together. The meanings, the laws, the customs, the institutions, the rituals. But below that or beneath that, the ways of thinking, the understanding, the assumptions by which a group maintains and orders itself. Now I'm going to read just a page as a background to life in Palestine here. That social world occupied a very small geographical space. Jewish Palestine comprised an area of about 7,000 square miles, slightly smaller than the state of Vermont. Isn't that amazing? Politically, it had become part of the Roman Empire in 63 BC, was governed by rulers appointed by Rome, until the death in 4 BC of Herod the Great, the most famous of the client kings who owed their kingship to Rome. It was administered as a single political unit, but after Herod's death, divided into three units, each ruled by one of Herod's sons. One of these units, Judea, which included Jerusalem, came under direct Roman rule in AD 6, administered by a series of Roman governors who replaced Herod's son. This Herod's son was a real loser. He lost his job. So he was replaced by these bureaucrats. The most famous one to us, of course, is Pilate. Palestine was still a largely agricultural and rural society composed of towns and small villages, many no larger than hamlets, inhabited largely by farmers who walked each day to their fields. You know, you lived in the little village and then walked to your field, and a word, the word for that field in ancient Israel was your nahala. And nahala is a word to describe your land in a way that you don't own it. It's inheritance. It means God has loaned you this land to you and your family for all generations or throughout all generations. It is owned by God. But it is the nahala that your family lives on, where really God feeds you and feeds your family, and the excess of your nahala then feeds the poor and the sojourners. Most were small landholders, though larger estates were emerging. Farming centered around grain, vegetables, fruit, wine, oil, and dates, as well as sheep, cattle, and goats. There were a number of cities, many of them established by Herod the Great and his successors. The rural areas tended to be Jewish, whereas the urban areas, with the exception of Jerusalem, had more of a mixed population because of the influx of Gentiles during the time of the Herods. This was called colonialism. Okay. The ways of the rural areas were old and relatively unchanged, whereas the cities were becoming increasingly more cosmopolitan because of the Gentiles and their ways. More importantly, it was a social world in crisis. And I'm going to stop there because we're going to move in now to what the crisis in this social world was. At the heart of Jewish social life in Palestine is what we would call the conventional wisdom. These are the ideas that kind of shape and hold a group of people together throughout the generations. And to Palestine Jewish people, it's really a mixture of several traditions. One was the folk wisdom that comes to us through like the book of Proverbs. You know, handed down little sayings, just how you live together. Folk wisdom, and that was coupled with the Torah, the written laws of the books of the Hebrew Bible. Laws especially around land and nahalad, how people live on the land and how people live with each other. And then on top of that were popular ideas that had grown out of the stories in the Torah. The main popular idea was one of rewards and punishments. That if your life is going well, you are being rewarded by God for being righteous. If your life is not going well, you are being punished by God for being wicked or not observing the Torah and the folk wisdom. Now, within the whole folk wisdom, then the folk wisdom tells you your place in the society. If you're a landowner, nahala owner, priest, husband, wife, father, oldest son, rich, poor, noble, peasant, man, woman, remember a fiddler on the roof, what the tradition does? It just tells you who you are and how you are to behave from the time you're born to your death. And it's all neatly set so everybody knows kind of how to function together. The folk wisdom does this. And part of the folk wisdom was to have a certain status of more righteous people and less righteous people. And then a certain shame that was connected on being less righteous. Now, the point that Marcus Borg makes is that this kind of conventional wisdom, folk popular ideas plus the Torah, what we call the law, this would have held Palestinian Jewish society together for decades and decades and even centuries and centuries if, at the time of Jesus, a crisis time had not come to really just shatter everything in that society. And this will now lead us to Jesus coming into this society as a spirit person. And there have probably been many spirit persons in societies, but occasionally a spirit person hits at the exact time of a tremendous crisis in the society. That person is there at that moment and then emerges within the crisis. I mean, think of Martin Luther King Jr., probably expected to spend his life as a parish pastor until the bus incident. And all of a sudden, he, as a deeply spirit person, was pulled into crisis. And then emerged then as one who the world will always remember. And now we're going to look at what the crisis was at the time of Jesus. Here's a Jewish world. And one thing that was already constantly pushing in on the Jewish world was Greek, of course, Greek-Roman culture, which produced the reaction in this world, of course, among the leadership of the ideas is to be more Jewish. Now, and this is very understandable if there's the push of an alien culture. The response is a core group that says we have to become even more what we are. Then with the Greek-Roman culture is the Roman occupation. Now, to understand the crisis at the time of Jesus is for us, and this is hard for us who are North American citizens of the United States, I'd have no trouble explaining this or understanding it myself in Nicaragua or El Salvador, and that is the capability of a large world empire superpower to push in on a small little country and really devastate it. And what I'm going to be talking about this crisis now is the devastation that comes to this people because of the Roman occupation. this is where I'll try now to explain that. Now we'll focus on the Roman occupation and where the crisis comes. Here is a situation in a little village, a small farmer with the Nahala that has been in that family for generations and generations. Part of the Torah, or the law that comes from the Hebrew scriptures, is the laws of the tithe. And part of being a faithful Jew is to give the tithe. That is both a welfare system and also pays for the priests and the temple. The tithe then, the various tithes, and we usually think of tithes as 10%, but by the time you combine the various tithes for the small farmer, it included about 20% of your crops. Then on top of this, now you have the Roman tax, which is a 1% land tax. Anybody, are you interested in tax history? Here we go. Land tax is about 1%. About 12% of your crops is called a crop tax. And then plus, on top of that, you have customs, tolls when you're going on the roads, and various tributes. Plus, on top of that, is the extra that Susan was talking about this morning, that is whatever the tax collector can manage to add on. It's called the value-added tax. Now, here is how these two different, the tithe and the Roman taxation. The tithe is not enforced by, any government power or soldiers or police. It is enforced by the social pressure of keeping the law of righteousness. The Roman tax is enforced by the Roman police.
Okay. Dan, could you say again what the tithe was? Was it like the rate of 10% and then you added?
Well, the question I haven't answered or haven't figured out is yet how the various tithes added up to about 20% of your crops. But it was various tithes that then were really the Jewish welfare system as well as paying for the temple and the priests in the temple. But I don't know how it added up to
it. That's okay.
Yeah. So. Now here's the situation of the small Jewish farmer. If you paid both the tithe and the Roman tax, you just went into debt and lost your Nahala. And then you would set up with a large landowner that took advantage of people going into debt. And then 50% of your crop would go to the landowner. Your family would have to live on the other 50%, which meant usually your children then would have to leave home, go someplace to find a job, go to somewhere in what was called the Jewish dispersion throughout the world. The family now was broken up. And then it was a constant battle between the collectors of the 50% that would come now from the absent land owner, who often would live far, far away. That would be your most, that would be your luckiest situation now if you had to pay both of these. Very likely you would just lose everything and become a day laborer. Or each day you would hope to have work to to provide food for your family. And the days that you did not find work, simply your family would not eat, or you would depend on the goodness of neighbors around you who had day labor. That would be the other. The other would be to go into such terrible debt that it was known that people would sell their children into slavery. People went into slavery themselves. Suicides were common in the midst of this despair. And then the landowners would take legal action in the midst of your debt, and the result could be debtor's prison. And usually the landowners won in the courts, a city landowner against a rural poor person. I don't know if you, sometimes justice is not equal. And you would usually lose in the courts. And then it would be debtor's prison. And then in that society, your wife, if you were a man, your wife would be very vulnerable. In that situation of being alone.
With the courts, Roman courts or Jewish courts?
This would have been the Roman courts, because...
What was the Roman tax?
Yeah. Well, it was a debt situation, and that was the occupying government. We know the tremendous hatred and burden of taxation leading to debt, because In the Jewish wars that ended in the year 70 AD, when the Jewish guerrilla armies actually took the city of Jerusalem for a brief time, the first place they went into the temple was where all the debt records were kept, and they destroyed them. That was the first place. Now, here was your dilemma, if you could think of this. Or let me just back up. Jewish kind of popular opinion now had a choice of going two ways. One way would have been to figure out as a society some way to really lower the tithe as an act of compassion so people could still live on their land and not along with their families. The other way was, with all of this pressure, to become more intense about keeping the law of the ancestors. And that second option is the option that won, that the idea makers were probably people that had enough land and enough money to be able to pay the both taxes and keep their families together. And therefore, the idea became that if you did not pay the full tithe, you became known as a person, there was a name for you, a non-observant. So many, many people chose, and what did you choose? Chose to break the ancient law of the Torah. And it probably broke their hearts to do that, because they chose to stay on their land and keep their families together. But if you did that, then you were called a non-observant, and another name for that was a sinner. Now this is beginning to pull things out of the New Testament. He ate with tax collectors and non-tithe givers, sinners. And so many, many chose. And now, as the pressure increases, the idea makers in the society push the idea even more that we must be pure. Okay, now, where does this idea come from? And I want to share something here that I'm not sure we as American Christians have even begun to comprehend, and that is the incredible importance of our image of God as to the way we live out our lives. The idea makers had the image of God as the main concern in the heart of God is purity. And that if there is a pure nation that follows all of the rules of God, then God will eventually come and save that nation from the Roman occupation. And therefore it is even more important that everyone pay the tithe. And it is even more important to discriminate against those who do not pay the tithe. Are you following? Because God was understood as the God who sits up there and is pure, holy, and separated from all unrighteousness and wickedness, and demands that the people of God be a people that follow all of the rules of righteousness, and therefore are the truly separated people. And as the pressure increased, this idea increased even more. So now what happens then is often what happens when a little nation is occupied by a great superpower, is the tragedy of that situation is that the people in the little nation turn against each other. And we know this today in South Africa. And this is what happened now in the Jewish social world. You had a line. And above that line were the righteous people. And those righteous people up here were enforced by renewal movements now that grew up in the crisis. One of those renewal movements was the Essenes, the people who left society out to the desert to be absolutely pure. The other were the Zealots who went into the hills. And many children of families who lost their land went into the hills, and often the whole family went into the hills to join the zealot armies, who then said, "We will live pure and righteous as God desires us when we drive the Romans out of the land." And then the most powerful group, not in terms of the numbers, but in terms of the influence, were the Pharisees, who at the time of Jesus now press to call the people of Israel to be a whole nation of priests who will follow the tithe rules and the rules of purity to perfection, so then that God will look down upon this nation and will save it. And I can't say enough to emphasize how well-meaning these people were, because they had a God image and they were following that God understanding, and they were following it faithfully, and they follow it more fervently in the midst of the crisis of the Roman taxation. But by following more fervently, they split Jewish society between those above the line who were pure and those below the line who were not. Now, I've completely lost my place. Okay, I'm above the line and below the line. Are you following so far?
At what point in time did Jesus appear in this crisis?
Jesus appeared in the midst of this crisis, and part of, if we were going into a Bible study, we could see how so many of the stories and the parables of landowners and day laborers and debtors and everything all come in out of the come into the teaching of Jesus.
I have a question about the word sinner.
Mm-hmm.
Was not, I didn't quite pick up if non-observant was equal to sinner, so
yeah,
that there were no other things that equal sin.
Oh, what I'm still fishing on this one. As far as I have it figured out now, that a non-observant, which was a word for the non-tithe giver, was called a sinner. But my assumption is that there were other people put into that class. I'm going to look at that right now, the above the line people and below the line. Below the line were these groups One were sinners, which were also the non-observants. And these are the people, probably a broader sense, these are the people that did not follow the Torah wisdom, or both the folk wisdom and especially the Torah rules. Do you know what I mean by Torah?
Yes.
It's basically Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. That these people not only did not follow the folk wisdom that we get in the book of Proverbs and the like, but also the rules of the law that come from the Torah. And so certainly then these non-tithe givers were included in the list of sinners. Now, and this is very helpful to me that very likely when they are saying he eats with tax collectors and sinners, that we can begin to think more specifically. I'll go back to my room and realize I missed the most important point. And that is the those who I call the idea setters, who by not the sword, but by ideas and social pressure kind of set the way society should be, had a major, major way of punishing those who went below the line. And the major way of punishing was to not share meal with those. This was your major social power of conformity. That part of deciding not to pay the tithe would mean that the neighbors that you have in your village who are well off enough that they can pay both and therefore be holy. That's amazing. You know, if you're rich, you can be religious. But what it meant was that you made the decision that table fellowship ended for you with all of these people who had the high standing and the good reputation. And part of the appeal of being one above the line was that you could join those people who practice the withholding of meal. Okay. Now here is... There's many other factors. This is more of a question because I haven't figured it out. But we have in Palestine a group of people called the Anawim, meaning the righteous poor, or people that were in poverty because of their righteousness. And the question is, are these the people that decided in order to be righteous to pay both of the taxes and then lost all of their land and then gathered together and considered themselves to be the righteous poor, and then in their helplessness, in their poverty, in their having lost everything, they gathered in the temple to plead and to cry out to God to come and save the nation? Does this make... makes sense? Never read that when I kind of made it up, but I think it sounds like it fits.
Yeah, where does that kind of leave the zealots?
They all were informed by this kind of politics of purity, but the zealot option was to leave society to go into the hills and to form guerrilla armies in order to drive out the Romans, so then a pure and holy nation could be re-established. They were, the leadership of the zealots, as I understand, were very pious that way. But they were the violent, that eventually led the whole nation into the war with the Romans that ended in 70, the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Well, the fun of reading this book is the kind of double agent spy gets caught in a zealot cave. You know, and you get to kind of read how at least in this author's story, how the zealot people kind of hid out in the. Also, probably include whole family groups, because when you went into the hills to join the zealot army, it was very important to bring your whole family, because if you left half of the family, then they would be possibly tortured until they revealed information as to where you were. Okay, I think I left, or I had this one group of the people below the line who were the sinners or the non-observants. After the non-observants, you had another group where the hatred of these people became more intense as the political pressure of the Roman Empire increased. And these were the outcasts, and they were just considered not part of Israel. There was an argument about whether there was any hope or forgiveness for non-observance. But these were the people that were considered completely hopeless and lost. You wouldn't eat with any of them, but these were the most hopeless, and they were considered even with the Gentiles in their hopelessness and their wickedness. One were the obvious, were the criminals. These were the murderers, the extortioners, and also grouped with them the prostitutes. And then there were the occupational groups that made you a non-Jew. And that included tax collectors. As we talked in Bible study this morning, those who collaborated with the Roman government to raise the taxes. And there were other occupational groupings that were very low, and I'm not sure which class of whether it was non-observant or outcast, but an occupational group like a shepherd would be down way below the line because a shepherd could not keep the Sabbath. A shepherd could not keep the rules. And then, hold this one group over here for a minute. These are all the hopeless people that are both the non-observants, the sinners, the tax collectors, the prostitutes, shepherds, other occupations that really put people into the area considered non-Jew. Then over here you have another group. Is this getting complicated? Over here you have another group who have tried to be righteous by paying the tithe, but by deciding to be righteous and to pay the tithe, they lose all of their land and become day laborers. And all of the folk wisdom, all of the popular wisdom, the conventional wisdom and the Torah law is set up for people who own land or have nahalah. So there are then become hundreds of subtle little ways to tell you that you aren't as good. And so you have a mentality of despair that is throughout the land. Both of those be below the line, but even those above the line who are no longer landed and are constantly dealing with sermons delivered to landed people. It's like being a single person and always going to church and hearing sermons about families. Anybody know what I mean? There's the constant voices that are saying, you're worthless, you're worthless, you're worthless, you're worthless. The idea setters up here are very much the minority, but they set the way of thinking for everybody. Okay, now, on top of all of this, all of this mentality, besides this, you have a nation that is seething with hatred towards the Roman occupation, And the conventional wisdom is war. It is a nation that has made the decision that the way that this is going to work itself out is to go to war. And it's only a matter of time until we go to war with the Romans. And anyone who would disagree with this is, I don't know what their word, but ours would be unpatriotic. This is the conventional wisdom that the answer is war. So you have a nation heading towards war, heading towards destruction. And once you understand this, when Jesus is talking about the wide road that leads to destruction, he is not talking about the medieval picture of hell, as I learned in Sunday school, or somewhere back there. The wide road that leads to destruction is a nation that is becoming more fanatic and more fanatic to take up the sword against the Roman occupation. Okay. Into this mix comes the spirit man, the holy man, who because of his experience in the spirit world that the Hebrew people called Yahweh, because of the vision of God, that informs for Jesus a completely different understanding of the Torah, of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. Jesus comes into this society and becomes the leader of a renewal movement, and this is now the opinion of Marcus Borg, that Jesus comes to bring a renewal movement that will save the nation, that will save the Jewish people from destruction, and will make it possible for the Jewish people to live their calling in the world as the people of God. Okay, that is, so that's where we'll go tomorrow. But let's just, let's talk, let me ask, did you get a sense of what it would feel like to be a very poor landowner, which a majority of people were, and how conventional wisdom maybe would have held these people together for generations and generations, but this crisis of the Roman taxation just literally tears you apart, your family, and your society apart. I'll stop there and let's just...
Did this Roman tax, is that when they put in into effect when Joseph and Mary had to go to the place of their birth to pay their tax?
Yeah, there were many different taxes, and that was one of them. And it was not the... was not the specific tax of the land tax or the crop tax. I'm not sure exactly. Andy?
I was just, as you were describing, Dan, I almost had a deja vu experience. I think for folks who were at Brian Rood's session this morning on El Salvador, he read the story of the peasant family that eventually was driven from the land as the taxes were raised up and found themselves in a city and a homeless people and so forth. And I just always was struck remembering the story of Archbishop Romero, some of the parallels. One of the things that made the people most angry was how much he associated with poor people who were losing their land, and the whole thing ended up being impure. Big controversy when he would not have a separate baptism service for wealthy children from poor children, baptize them all together. And the wealthy were outraged because this was impure for the children. So what you were talking about was this place so close to home in many situations we see today. Yeah.
The more I read into this, the more I realize the similarity of places in our world, especially Central America. Wow, it's just... Yeah.
I have been aware, too, for our African-American community in this country, and the legacy of slavery and the tenant farming, and I've known how that community is identified with the scripture and the call to set the captives free, so to speak. But this economic stuff is still part of their life today, in terms of going into not being able to own their own homes, and vast majority of people in the city renting, and how easy it is to fall into debt, and to get stuck and behind, or lose what you have, and the day labor situation with African-American men today in our society, and how that shatters families.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much.
Yeah, I never realized so I read The Shadow of the Galilee and some of the descriptions in there, how this shattered families. You know, the children of family could not stay home and be part of that.
And if you're going, the whole issue about making it in our society means you have to move away from the ghetto. And even as I work with young black people in the city in L.A., like in my mind, yeah, it was really good. We could get you a scholarship to go to CLU, to California Lutheran University. But that meant they had to leave their culture and their family to go make it,
mm-hmm.
so to speak. And then if you did make it, then you were alien if you returned. Mm-hmm. So that's hard.
I read this 5 years ago. We were five weeks in South Africa, and the pain, I think, of that trip, and the weeping and the tears for me is how the shattering of families. I just went away from there realizing the family that lives, the black or so-called colored family in South Africa that actually grows up living together is the rare exception. So the same things as landlessness, day labor, mining hundreds of miles from home, the women working as maids in the cities. It's similarities are many, they abound. Who else? Yeah.
I thought it was very interesting that the major social power of conformity was not sharing the meals, because it makes every meal that was had that much more important. Mm-hmm. So Jesus was not just associating with Zacchaeus, he was inviting himself over for a meal against the social pressure of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So this association takes on double strength almost when the meals are shared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Does this remind you of the Bible study?
Yeah.
This morning?
And, answers questions.
Begins to. Since I started this journey to go back and read the Gospels, again with this as a background, just.
That comment too helps make more sense of the Corinthians, the debate and the problem with the people eating apart from each other.
Mm-hmm.
Paul just said, they know we eat together.
I remember how angry Paul was when the eating fellowship was being broken.
There's kind of a wonderful visual of that in a TV production that was put on a few years ago called Peter and Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul goes and eats with the Gentiles, and they're having a wild, exuberant party.
Mm-hmm.
And he's eating all this meat that he shouldn't be eating and just having a wonderful time. And of course, the faithful Jews are aghast at this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was the falling out between Peter and Paul. Paul speaks out against Peter, saying, "No, you were eating with him." Then some more people came. from Jerusalem and you quit dealing with
him. Hold him back.
Called him a hypocrite.
I confronted Peter to his face.
Right.
Remember that?
Well, their argument was always the tradition and the social pressure.
Mm-hmm. And what we're beginning, and this is what I want to spend our session 5 on, notice how the New Testament church is still deeply influenced by the table fellowship ministry of Jesus.
I was just wondering, when you were talking about the idea setters, how that kind of infiltrated society, what sort of dissemination of ideas there was in the culture, did you have a notion of that?
What was it? Yeah, today it would come through the media and
right,
television.
I was wondering at that time.
Yeah, it would be, I'm going to guess, because I don't know, because in the New Testament you have the scribes and the Pharisees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scribes were the ones who did the teaching to all the people, and then the Pharisees, as I understand them, let's always remember the Pharisees is not evil people. They were doing their very, very best according to the God image that they held. How in a society like this where ideas kind of dispersed, it was probably through the institutions they had, the weekly teaching in the synagogue.
Mm-hmm.
Would be my guess, might be the main, plus just talking. This wasn't a very large country.
Right.
It didn't take that long for an idea to kind of... notice the ideas came to you and told you what your worth was. And then what you did in that society until someone might come along and say there's possibly a different way of thinking is you believed that. You believed you were garbage. You believed you were worthless. You believed that you were ought to be despised and that you were hopeless. And at least the second line down below the non-observant to get down to the outcast, you were hopeless. To ever get back in. So your life was already determined from today to the day of my death. I am a hopeless, worthless person in this society. That's how I must live and that's how I must die. The word gospel begins to take on the kind of meaning now to me that kind of gives me goosebumps. The good news.
I
heard a voice.
I think it might be important for us to consider how much a role that we as a church play as the image makers when it comes to the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people have resistance to different stereotypes or different understandings of inclusive language. And yet when we think about the impact that it has to speak about God in particular language, whether it's male-female or light and dark, that the racist implications and the exclusions are so powerful that we are still reinforcing a value system that doesn't get questioned by people growing up in the church that, it's always better to be lighter as opposed to darker. It's always better to think of God and be more male because that's more holy. That we still in the church are doing a lot of that image management for who God is and what God wants for us.
Yeah. I'm beginning to think that the church is still being involved in the political realm and social statements and social work, then is our greatest power in society is what can we do to change the God image of this nation in North America. By changing the God image, I don't mean finding one that isn't in the Bible. And the call would be to rediscover the God image of Jesus. I don't know if there's anything more important that we, and radical, revolutionary, and frightening, and the word that Susan used in the Bible study, was it risky or dangerous? Dangerous. Have you ever thought of that the most dangerous thing maybe the church can do in the society is to begin talking about a God image that is different than the popular piety?
That was going to be my question in relationship to what was set up above there, is that what in America today or in the church today, how would you describe the God image? A God of piety, a punitive image, or not too much different from the social life of the people of Palestine at that time. I'm asking you, Dan, how would you describe that God image?
I was hoping you were just kind of raising a discussion. I want to work on this, and I just have a goal next time I come back to Holden to be ready to really hit this one head on. Person that's working on this, I think, in a wonderful way is Terry Fredheim at Luther Northwestern Seminary. But what do we do with this God image as God, as all-powerful, in control, sitting on his throne in heaven, Jesus at his right hand, running the world and setting up a hierarchy of relationships that go from God all the way down to the more worthless, down to the rocks. And also similarly to the ideas we had of a God image of God whose main concern is that people shape up and behave, and those who don't are out. And I would ask the question, when we talk about the gay-lesbian issue in our churches, is our insight on it coming more from a God who is up there sitting on a throne demanding purity? Or is our understanding of this issue coming from the God of Jesus Christ that we're going to find out tomorrow, seeing the central to the heart of God is compassion, and then Jesus calling for society to arrange itself in what Marcus Borg calls the politics of compassion? And I would challenge us, not only in this issue of gay and lesbian people, but every issue in the church, what is our God image that we're bringing to this discussion and to this issue?
Some of the leadership in our parish wear buttons that say, "The body of Christ has AIDS."
I think the God of the prosperity doctrine is mm-hmm. very much alive and well, even in the Lutheran Church, which declares that that's not the way it is. But if you look at most churches, those with the bucks are courted, and those without are kind of shoved behind.
Do the Orthodox Jewish people of today consider that because of this history they have at the time of the crisis, do they still adhere to tithing and all the Torah, or have they, the Jewish people of today, have they modified their
If I need to hold that, because the only thing, if I could help you see the magnitude of your question. I mean, you have asked a magnificent question, because you have asked me to explain Judaism. Which is, is an immense diversity. My only challenge would be to go learn.
There are the Reformed Jews and mm-hmm. the Conservatives,
right.
Orthodox.
Yeah, and the Orthodox would be much closer to
But they even have a whole, I mean, there's 2,000 years of history from this time where they've been shaped, molded, grown, had great teachers, great rabbis.
Well,
you know, so it isn't, it wouldn't be.
They won't even strike a match on the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there would be some, that would still follow very, very strictly. Yeah. Who else? I think it is. It's time. Well, thank you for joining me in this journey into their life. And tomorrow, my dream tomorrow will be to try, and I know I won't do it well enough, and wish I could do it perfectly, but is to see how the ministry and the teaching of Jesus fits, and the word fit would be wrong, doesn't fit, you know, into this social setting. And really, why Jesus was, you know, what Jesus did and what he said and what it meant now in this type of social arrangement that Jesus comes into. Let us share a closing prayer. Loving God of compassion, help us to know you. Give your Holy Spirit that we understand you. Help us in our lives, in this society, in this world, to be your people.